show that proves you don't have to settle for life the way it is. You can do the things you love. You can face your challenges head on. You can start down the path to living the life that you've always imagined. It's called Growing Bolder, and I'm Mark Middleton. That guy over there is Bill Schaefer, a couple of hardworking journalists who challenge you by bringing in world-renowned experts, best-selling authors, and ordinary people that are living extraordinary lives.
Growing Bolder is a radio show, a TV show, a magazine, a website, and more, all of which offer you hope, inspiration, and possibility. And in the next hour, TV's Lou Grant, Ed Asner, is here. You're going to love what this guy has to say about life. And we're going to talk to one of the top independent filmmakers going today about never giving up on your dreams. And we'll meet a woman who's overcome tragedy after tragedy in a way we can all learn from, and someone else who had to become somebody else to discover herself. Amazing people, amazing stories. It's time for Growing Bolder. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
Well, folks, you are in for a treat. We just had a very brief pre-interview, if you will, with our next guest. And if he is anything like he was then, it's going to be fabulous. Few actors fortunate enough to be able to bring to life a role in such a way that their character lives on long after that part is finished and become an iconic fixture of American pop culture. But our next guest has done exactly that. Just say two syllables and everyone will know exactly who it is. Lou Grant.
Yeah, that's what you do know, but here's what you need to know. Ed Asner's had a prolific career. The guy continues, even at the age of 83, to maintain a schedule so robust it would exhaust a 25-year-old. He is one of the most honored actors in the history of television. He's been awarded 7 Emmys, 16 nominations, 5 Golden Globes. Let's say hi to the great Ed Asner. How you doing, Ed?
I make a living.
Oh, my gosh. We thought you'd be a lot more up and positive after hearing an introduction like that.
Well, I know, but it drives me into my shell. The gloriousness of that introduction is just too much. I can't handle it.
You know, it's funny, and honestly, Ed, you probably don't like it because you're not the kind of guy that looks backwards. You are so busy and doing so much, it seems like you've got your eyes on tomorrow.
I have my eye on the prize, you know. I'm waiting for the Nobel.
Have you been nominated?
No.
Well, we got to work on that.
Well, I wonder if I could talk you guys into doing something about that.
Oh, you and everybody else.
Yeah. Is that right? You're besieged by all?
Mark is working up a nomination for Cloris Leachman right now. She called us we had her on the radio. She was sitting in a dentist chair. That's how dedicated she is to being on this program.
I pity that poor dentist.
Hey, Ed, let's talk about your career just a little bit
Let me finish this prune. Wait a minute.
While you're finishing the prune, here's the question, if you will. You know, most everybody, if not everybody worldwide, knows you for your iconic stature as a television actor. But, you know, one constant thread throughout your career has been the stage. I mean, what has drawn you to Broadway and back to Broadway time and time again?
It was a wonderful role. It was a wonderful play. I was with magnificent actors. It was a win-win situation. And I wasn't going to be there forever.
You weren't kidding about eating that prune, were you?
Yeah, you want one?
No, I don't need one. Thank you.
It'll take the travel.
Hey, listen, Ed, Broadway is...
I wonder if you could.
Broadway's, you know, everybody knows, that's a rigorous gig. It's not like TV or sitcom where you sit around and every once in a while someone goes, hey, Ed, go get your Emmy.
No, you're all wrong. I only had 2 scenes, and they were scene-stealing scenes, because that was the majority of the humor of the play. So it was a win-win there, too.
And we're talking about the play Grace, and Ed, yeah. you really were. I mean, you stole the show.
Paul Rudd. I mean, I can't say enough about his wonderful work. He is a wonderful actor. He just is. He shines. He took this unattractive role, the lead, actually, and he crafted it beautifully. I wish I could do that.
You've done it time and time again. Folks, we're talking to Ed Asner, who really is, I guess he's achieved.
This is the only show I'm starring in this year, you know.
Well, you've got top billing. This is what we like to call the A block, Ed, and we reserved it for you. But let's talk about one of your latest projects, because you have toured the country for, what, 3 or 4 years now in a one-man show that has received rave reviews as you bring Franklin Delano Roosevelt to life in your play FDR. What's it like playing FDR?
Well, it's a great honor, for one thing. I adored the man, and I was awed by him. I don't look like him, I don't sound like him, but I try to approach him so that when I say his words, it resonates in the minds of the people and in the hearts of the people. I think that he should be a crash course for everybody planning to run for office to see what great leaders are made of.
Who's coming to see it, Ed? Are you getting a good mix of people that maybe were not even born when FDR was in office?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that. But I get a lot of people who want to hear, who want to be reminded of the things that they were in awe of when they were growing up. And we have not had his like since then. We've had some close calls. Kennedy certainly was a good one. Who else would you put in that line?
Millard Fillmore.
Oh, yeah. That was the predecessor. Where are you guys?
We're in Orlando. Where are you?
You're in Orlando.
Yeah, the media capital of the world.
Yeah, also possibly a center for tornadoes, right?
Occasionally, but not this week, fortunately.
Mostly
not
hurricanes, but a great place for you to come bring the FDR show.
I think I did do it there. I'm not sure, but I did do it there maybe in the first or second year.
Oh.
But you know what we are home to is Disney, and at least a big part of Disney.
You certainly are.
And wasn't Disney Pixar behind Up, which of the many roles you've played, did that surprise you as much as any, the response that got?
It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. How can you deny it? It just does everything. I don't know about surprise. When I finally saw the totality of it and I saw how people responded to it, it's a double love story, and you get two whacks for the price of one, and there's just something magical about it.
And Ed, that film was a few years ago, but you'd never sit still. We talked about Broadway and FDR. You're doing a number of guest TV shots. I saw you on Hawaii Five-0, Hot in Cleveland. You're working on a feature film with the great Carol Kane called Should Have Been Romeo. Are you ever going to slow down?
You heard what Satchel Paige said, don't you?
That he could get in bed before the lights, when he turned the lights off before it got dark.
Nobody else said you slow down. You hear those footsteps behind you.
Yeah.
So you keep moving.
Yeah.
Hey, Ed, we're not out of time yet. I just don't want to run out of time. So hopefully we'll double back with another question. But we always like to ask someone like you, who is a great role model for everybody out there, what they've learned about life in general. What can we learn from you? Yeah, you're just an actor, but you're really more than that. What have you learned about trying to remain significant, if you will, vital as you enter your mid-80s?
Humor is one of the greatest salves that you can discover, that you can use, that you can employ, where you can find a way to make something comic or funny, do so, because it reduces the tension, it eases the heart and the mind. Steadfastness is another thing. I like to think that whatever I said in the beginning, I stay with at the end, and unless I can confess to being transformed by logic. And logic, of course, is the greatest weapon in the world.
And Ed believes you should enjoy a good prune every once in a while.
Oh, no, several. I would preach the practice of pruning very strongly.
Hey, what's you got so many years left. What's on your to-do list, Ed? I mean, you know, you've
very generous of you. I didn't know I had so many years. Oh, thank you, thank you.
Well, we are certainly hoping so. I mean, you've acted with John Wayne and Robert Mitchum and Barbara Stanwyck. You've been
buried them all.
You've been on the growing. you've been on the Growing Boulder radio show. Scratch that from your bucket list. What's left undone for you?
What's left undone? To win the girl.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think to be a hero, I want to be a hero.
What is a hero? What would you have to do?
I guess demolish the enemy and hold up the prize of the deed to the USA.
You know, Ed, you get so many great roles, and you're very prolific in an industry where a lot of people have a hard time. There's ageism everywhere, especially in Hollywood.
Boy.
But you are still as good as ever, maybe better, you know, honestly. You know, we mentioned Cloris Leachman earlier. She's as funny as she's ever been. Are we starting to appreciate that? Are we starting to get that just because you're over 40 or 50 or whatever, you can still be a dynamic part of creativity?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. And they keep trying to make, you know, the bucket list. And they keep trying to make movies with old people as the stars. It does work because young people are the market that they aim for, who shill out the shillings for admission. So, all right, we weather that. And as long as we can keep popping up occasionally and surprise the hell out of everybody who's watching, that's all it counts, to show the energy, that we still have energy. But above all, the most important thing of all is to have an effective mind, to show that mind of yours is as sharp and as witty as it ever was. In Cloris's case, it's frightening.
And you know what? You're pretty close behind her, Ed. I want to, honest to goodness, thank you so much for what you've done, what you're doing right now, and what you're going to do. And here's my kiss off for you. I hope you like this. In his role as Lou Grant in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, that will never be forgotten. But what impresses us the most about the guy you just heard, folks, is at the age of 83, he is living life on his terms. He is doing what he loves, and he is doing a lot of it. Catch him on TV, at the movies, on Broadway, and keep an eye out for his play, FDR, and learn a little something about the way it used to be. He is Ed Asner. Time now for our Boulder Nutrition segment, and one disease that's running rampant these days is high blood pressure. Do you know there's a 90% chance at some time in your life you'll have to deal with it? And as you get older, the chances get greater. Now, did you know there's something you can add to your diet to help you beat it? Well, here's registered dietitian and nutrition expert, Dr. Susan Mitchell.
Bill, I don't know if you had these at lunch when you were in grade school, but I'll never forget those bright purple sliced canned beets the cafeteria lady would dump on the tray. Well, they're back, and believe it or not, that's great news for more than 65 million Americans with high blood pressure. Beets may be an effective way to bring your blood pressure down. A recent study found that one cup of beet juice a day lowered blood pressure about 10%. Why? Because beets contain a high level of nitrates that convert to nitric oxide, which expands in your veins and arteries, resulting in improved blood flow to the brain and heart.
Why does it have to be beets, though? Because you make a great point. A lot of people don't like them, so they'd probably have to do a lot more than just lower your blood pressure to get people to eat them.
Well, Bill, they do. Beets are low in calories and contain potassium, vitamin C, folate, and fiber. No doubt you've heard the chatter about inflammation in the body and the tie to heart disease and other health issues. Well, beets contain betaine, which helps to lower the homocysteine level in the body tied to that inflammation. Toss them in salads, throw them in a vegetable smoothie, or my favorite, roast them. And an FYI, beet juice can turn your urine pink because of the natural, colorful pigments. But this is nothing that you have to be concerned about. Give them a try because big benefits come from beets.
Up next, someone who's discovered the best way to get the most out of retirement is to give back. This is Growing Boulder.
So Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
There's a new movement underway in the healthcare industry we want to talk about, a new movement that makes a big difference to patients everywhere. And it's only happening because a group of selfless nurses who, despite the fact that they work in a highly stressful, exhausting profession, have seen a greater need out there, and they are volunteering even more hours to help fill it.
Yeah, it's called Faith Community Nursing, which is a specialized practice that understands that health is not just the absence of illness, but it's really so much more. They focus on the patient's spirit and holistic health to trigger healing or prevent and minimize illness. There are over 15,000 faith community nurses across the country, and one of the very best is Betsy McKeeby. Hey, Betsy, how are you?
Hello, doing well. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, before we get too deep into this, how do we do defining what you do? Is that a pretty good description of faith community nursing or not?
You did a great job. It is working to combine the elements of faith with the knowledge that we have about physical health so that the person can reach their wholeness. So great description.
So what comes first, the chicken or the egg, when it comes to someone like you? Were you drawn to this because, A, you were a nurse and wanted to help people feel better, or, B, because of your strong faith-based background?
My whole interest in nursing began with not knowing what nursing was even going to be, and was told about whole person health, but quickly learned, even though that's been over 30 years ago, that it's really hard to take care of that in an acute care hospital environment. And so when the parish nursing or faith community nursing came along, it seemed like a great way to really share what I had felt like was should be the priority all along. So the faith was there, the desire to keep the physical, and then a program that met those needs.
Hey, Betsy, help us visualize what we mean by faith community nursing. This isn't where you like go into people's homes, is it?
You actually can, but you're not a home health nurse. You're there because that's their world. So you're meeting them wherever they are. So it could be at the church, could be in a hospital, could be in their own home.
So what makes a good faith community nurse? You know, what are the skills that you have to do the job in a way that you feel satisfied?
You have to have a passion for people, be wanting to listen to them and what their priorities are, what they see as needs. Have to be able to accept their faith, to share your faith, have enough life experience that you understand everybody's coming with different problems and you're not going to judge based on where they are.
You know, I was also wondering if faith community nursing also helps the caregivers or the people who are in charge of watching over somebody's health, and come to find that the person we're talking to right now, Betsy McKeeby, helped design a 5-day course that teaches counselors how to better minister to people, especially heart patients, so the caregivers know exactly what they're going through.
We did develop that, and it was extremely rewarding because, yes, caregiving can be extremely stressful. And in some roles, the caregivers die before the person that was originally seen as the patient. So helping the caregivers know options, find respite, have the support they need is critical.
And Betsy, help us understand how the faith part of this works, because I'm guessing that, you know, you want to minister people in a way that's most advantageous to them. But when people are facing health crises, are they more open to maybe making some judgments, some leaps of faith, if you will?
Everybody's going to handle it differently, but yes, when we realize our own vulnerability, it does help us reflect more on what our priorities are, what we would want to have as a legacy and eternity. So, yes, the willingness to talk about faith becomes more open.
And now that you're doing what you do and knowing what you do know, it almost seems like it would be impossible for you to separate the two, you know, trying to care for someone's physical being and not care for their spiritual being.
Right. And you can't separate them. And so to stop and say, I can't talk about that, I'm going to call your pastor, your chaplain as your first out, would never be acceptable. But recognizing that they are specialists in the spiritual and can offer something even more in-depth than I can on those areas, we can work as a team.
Hey, Betsy, we're big fans of you, you know, as well as what you do. We like people that, you know, really want to make a difference in the community and really take the time to give back. Can you give us just a word about what you think all of our obligation is, our commitment is to try to make our community a better place, no matter what age we are?
I agree that it doesn't matter what our age is. If we don't have a purpose, a reason for getting up each day, then we're going to be very introspective. We're not going to tend to be a happy person. So recognizing that, yes, we do have something we can give helps me feel like what I'm doing has value, but I think it does for other people too.
Yeah, there's definitely no question that we get more back when we give to others. We hear that with almost every guest we talk to on the show, and even somebody in the nursing profession. I mean, it's very interesting, as overworked as you are and as many years as you've done it, you're still willing to step out and to do more for people who are in need. And we want to thank Nurse Betsy McKeeby, especially Betsy, for your 40 years in caring for people and your desire to volunteer your skills and experience to help even more. Up next, an incredible example of surviving and thriving from a woman who battled cancer twice, fought heart disease, and overcame the death of her husband to accomplish something remarkable. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
This, of course, is Growing Bolder, the show that proves that no matter what life throws at you, it is possible to get back on your feet, to fight through, and to live a life that you never thought possible. And in just a minute, folks, I know you're going to be thinking, if our next guest was able to do it, then it's got to be possible for just about anybody, because what this woman has been through is almost beyond belief. She has proved what surviving and thriving really means.
I know. I mean, what would you do if you had breast cancer? You fought your way through it, only to see your husband killed in a freak accident. Then you find another lump on your breast. You do the cancer thing all over again, and then find your heart's been so weakened by the treatments that you have to have a transplant or die. Now, that's just part of a story of a woman who was so incredible, so courageous, and so amazing that we had to bring her on the program. We're very anxious to say hi to Tony Wilde. How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing great. Good morning, guys.
Do people kind of hesitate to ask, how you doing?
You know, for a while, I think they did, but now everything is so positive and upbeat, and I'm just so happy to be alive. I want to share that with people.
Yeah, well, we're going to ask you how in the world that's possible after we go through a little bit of your story here, because I know our listeners are thinking that to go through what you've been through, you're probably about 102 years old, but you're just 50. You must have been shocked beyond belief to find you had breast cancer when you were, what, 29?
29, yes. I thought it was kind of unheard of, but I am in the medical profession, so being in the medical profession, I know anything is possible at any time, any stage of life.
You know what? When Bill was sharing your story with me just a moment ago, it was hard to understand how you could continue on, but it really takes 5 seconds of hearing your voice, the enthusiasm, the nature of your voice to understand why you have made it, how you have made it. Attitude is everything, isn't it?
I truly believe that, and I think a positive attitude has definitely gotten me to the point where I am today. Because when you hear my story, read my story, you know, many people would probably say, I'm just going to give up. There's absolutely no way that this could have a good outcome. But I was one of those people that absolutely refused to believe that there was not something good out there waiting for me.
You know, out of all the stuff that happened to you, Tony, I'm thinking probably was the worst what happened to your husband. Can you tell us about that?
You know, that was probably one of the deepest, darkest days of my life because it was supposed to be one of the most joyous occasions. We were actually celebrating my 5 years of being cancer-free. And at that point, I thought, you know, this is the best day, and my doctors gave me the go-ahead to start thinking about a family. And little did I know sort of what was lurking out in the background. And yeah, that was definitely hard. And the hard part was the fact that I was right there and I had to witness this. And to this day, I don't know how it wasn't both of us that were involved in this accident.
You were on the road going on vacation. You had a flat tire, right?
That's correct, on the interstate. It was an absolutely beautiful Sunday afternoon, not a cloud in the sky. And, you know, it's still almost unbelievable when I sit back and truly think of that day.
A day that would take most of us forever, if then, to get over. But less than a year later, tragedy strikes again when you find the unthinkable, another lump. You know, most of us try to prepare ourselves to bounce back once or twice. At any point did you think, you know what, I just can't do this?
Honestly, no, because I guess you can say I've always been a fighter. I was one of three children, being the only girl. So growing up, I was always challenged by my brothers and always wanted to do what they did and, you know, do it better. Or I had to sort of fight for seconds in the family if I wanted seconds at the dinner table. So I consider myself to be somewhat independent and a fighter.
Even with the new heart, I mean, mentally, that must have... How do you deal with having somebody else's heart in your chest?
It's something that still kind of to this day kind of gets me choked up. Especially because when my husband was killed, I decided to let him be an organ donor, so I was able to provide life for three other families. And lo and behold, it came back, and, you know, it was sort of full circle that I found myself in that same situation, and there was a family out there that was generous enough to donate their loved one's organs in order to provide me that second chance.
Tony, we hear something in the background. Are you at a swing set? Or are you hooked up to a medical device? What is that noise?
Actually, that's my oven beeping telling me it's time to take out my cookies.
Uh-oh. Well, we'll move on with the interview so you can get to the cookies. You know, you have done something in the aftermath of all of this that really seems to represent something for a lot of people, and that is completing a marathon. What made you want to do that, and what did that mean to you to be able to do it?
For me, I wanted to do something that I could honor my donor. And I thought, what a better way to honor life and honor my donor than to do something that I was unable to do before my transplant. So I started running, and I started running a little bit more, and I started thinking, okay, what would be the ultimate here? So I set my sights on doing a marathon, and I completed my first one in February. And for me, I thought that was sort of going to be, you know, my bucket list. I checked it off, did it, been there, done that. But I found myself wanting to do a second one. So I've signed up for a second one next March, and I want to challenge myself to even beat my time from February.
I think, Tony, if we let you go without asking this question, we'd really be missing a great opportunity. What would you say you've learned about the true meaning of life?
That each and every day is something to be cherished because we never know what tomorrow holds, nor do we know, you know, what our future holds. So I'm a firm believer of living in the moment and doing those things that you want to do and, you know, kind of living a life with no regrets.
Well, I tell you what, you'll regret it if you don't get those cookies out of the oven.
So, you're probably right.
And it surely is one thing for someone to have the courage and the strength to fight their way through so many challenges and setbacks, but only the most amazing among us would be willing to tell that story again and again to try to spread hope and inspiration and possibility. And we want to thank you, Tony Wilde, for all that you're doing, for setting the inspiration by running the marathons and showing people that if you can get over what you've been through and live the rest of your life, then it's possible for us to deal with our issues too. Many, many thanks to Tony Wilde. Up next, his lifelong dream was a long shot, to make it as a filmmaker in Hollywood. It wasn't easy, and it didn't happen overnight, but wait till you hear how he got there. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
And now we're going to talk a little bit about how even the most unlikely dreams can come true if you catch a few breaks and if you never give up. I mean, what would you say to someone who tells you that he wants to write screenplays or direct feature films? You'd probably tell him to find a dream that is actually attainable.
It is, in fact, though, a dream that our next guest has had ever since he was just a little lad. It's just that kids from Decatur, Illinois, don't often find their way all the way to Hollywood and then actually work in the business once they get there. But this guy actually did. Was not a direct path. It wasn't paved without plenty of struggles. But now, in his 50s, he seems to be hitting his peak, working at a prolific pace and living the life that he's always wanted. So let's say hi to the man behind such projects as Vampire Trailer Park, Stan Lee's Lightspeed, and his latest release, a sequel to the 1959 cult classic Killer Shrews, the one and only Return of the Killer Shrews. Let's welcome Steve Latchaw. Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm very good, guys. Very good. I'm glad to be on the show.
Is your life as exciting and interesting as it sounds?
Yeah. I was at the grocery store last night. I went back today to buy cat litter. So far, you know, you don't really think about it, I don't think, in those terms. It's just sort of you find something you enjoy doing, and you know you're thankful, you're blessed that you're able to do it, and you just enjoy it, I think.
And, you know, we want to talk to you about that thread. We'll get to the Return of the Killer Shrews in a moment, because that's an incredible film. Our producer, Jill, absolutely loved it. But what you said is you find something you love and you just do it. But many people cannot do that. How hard was it for you to continue to chase your dream into your 50s?
I think the hardest part of it is the last part of your sentence, continuing to chase your dream. And I think I've had a lot of life experiences, as everybody else does. I went through a divorce about 10 years ago, and I've raised a son and got a grandson now. And you start to learn that there's things in life that are more important. I was very driven early in my career. I had to be a success. I had to get things done. I had to accomplish X, Y, and Z by certain times, and then life issues pop up, and then you realize that what keeps you young, I think, are the dreams that you pursue, but you think about them differently. You think about them less as intense career goals and more just trying to find the pleasure and enjoyment. I'm enjoying it more now than I did 15 or 20 years ago. It's not that I don't take the work seriously. I don't take myself as seriously, and I think that's important, and I'm more in touch with that 14-year-old kid that I was when I first was interested in this now than I was probably 20 years ago.
And you fought such a hard fight, Steve. I mean, and you are an incredible writer, an excellent director. You really are a guy with a vision. You could make any movie you want. So why would you choose to make a sequel to a film considered one of the worst of all time, The Killer Shrews?
Well, it's not. First of all, it's not that. It's not that bad. The original is a lot of fun. It had a huge influence on a guy named George Romero, who later made Night of the Living Dead. And it's sort of the first horror picture that had a group of people trapped in a house and their monsters coming after them. It got a bad rap about 30 years ago. A book came out called The Golden Turkey Awards that sort of purported to talk about all these horrible movies, and some of them weren't that bad. I mean, it's a goofy film. It's not a classic, but it's a lot of fun. The reason we did it, I have been friends with an actor named James Best for about 25 years. Close friends. Jimmy made this movie in 6 days in 1959, and for about 5 years I teased him that we should do a sequel, and he thought I was crazy for 5 years, and then we started exchanging ideas, and it took about 20 years, but we finally got it done.
Can people see it yet? I mean, we were fortunate enough to have an advanced screener. Where can people watch this film?
Well, our distributor is selling it domestically and overseas right now. It looks like we're going to have this out on DVD in time for Halloween, which is appropriate. We're going to put out a DVD that will contain our film, the sequel, plus the original as a bonus feature. So look for it in time for Halloween this year.
And what were you trying to do, Steve? I mean, is there a formula to creating, a cult classic? I'm guessing that's what it was. I mean, there were parts of this film when I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. You know, some of it is so over the top. It's genuinely funny, genuinely interesting, but a strange combination of a lot of different stuff. Are those the ingredients that make a cult film?
Well, you don't set out to make a cult film. I think the idea was that there's a certain market, or has been on networks like the Sci-Fi Channel right now, for what they call their Saturday monster movies. And frequently the monster is a CGI or computer creation. There's a group of people in an isolated circumstance, and they're very strict in terms of their formatting. And we knew we had to sort of riff on that. But neither Jimmy or myself or Pat Moran, who collaborated with us as a producer and on the screenplay, we didn't really want to do just a straight horror film. We wanted to try to do sort of a tribute to the drive-in pictures of the 50s and 60s, and we also wanted to kind of send them up. So we wanted to have some comedy in there, which is pretty obvious, and we just sort of stirred it up and came up with a script that we liked and cast it. And we were changing the script as the film progressed. But that's kind of the mixture. That's why it has a lot of different levels. There was a movie that came out a couple of years ago called Shaun of the Dead. And it was a film that had a combination of humor and a little bit of pathos, and a little bit of action and gore, and all kind of in one mixture. And that was kind of the tone we were going for.
Talking with Steve Latch on, Steve, you are far from a one-trick pony as a filmmaker. I mean, you worked with Dolph Lundgren in Command Performance. That was a huge project. You did a great documentary on the Beach Boys. What's your cup of tea? What's your passion?
You know, to be honest with you, everybody says, don't you want to make the modern horror films? And I tend to lean more towards, believe it or not, Westerns. I would love to make a Western. I did a family film that was sort of a Western called American Black Beauty. If I could go out and make a movie before I die, like It's a Wonderful Life, that has such a huge effect on so many people, that would be a real goal. I'm kind of all over the map. I like a lot of different kinds of films. I've done so many action adventure things that's sort of something I'm good at. But you always want to do other things. So I just kind of keep my head open, and if I get an idea for something, it's like, well, okay, has anybody done that? No. Well, let's give it a shot.
And Steve, it takes incredible courage to do that. I mean, you didn't go out there to get rich. I mean, you had a dream that started when you were 14 years old, and you hung on to that dream. You worked whatever job you had to do to keep focused on it. You up and moved like everybody else does to Hollywood, and you were able to persevere, and you were able to fight through, and you were able to make that dream come true. And his latest film is The Return of the Killer Shrews, available at fine video outlets everywhere. Make sure to find it. We've been talking with screenwriter, director, and anything else he needs to be extraordinaire, Mr. Steve Latshaw. Thanks, Steve.
Well, folks, that's it for now. But remember, growing bolder doesn't stop here. In fact, this is just one link in a pretty impressive chain. You'll find hundreds of more interviews, just like the ones you've heard today, with TV stars, movie stars, rock stars, sports stars, authors, business leaders, medical experts, wellness experts, financial experts, travel experts, you name it, including regular people doing incredible things, all at growingbolder.com.
Are you growing bolder? See you next time.
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.